Okay, welcome everyone. You all made it to the final session for today. So my name is Bart Willems. I'm an application architect at Arduino. And for the next hour and 50 minutes, I will be talking to you about test-driven development using Visual Studio 2010. So I don't want to keep you here any longer than strictly necessary, so I'm going to immediately start with a short look at our agenda. I'll start with a short introduction to tell you why I actually think it's important that I talk about test-driven development today. Then I move on to unit testing, because of course you need some basic unit testing skills before you can start applying test-driven development. Then I move on to test-driven development itself. Of course, this will probably take the biggest part of this presentation. And in the end, if time permits, I'll also talk just a little bit about BDD, behavior-driven development. Let's first just start with an introduction. So therefore, we have to go back in time. And we have to go to the year 1999. And 1999 in itself was not such a special year. It was a year of certain things. For example, we were still using Windows 98, second edition. Nothing important. It was also the year that .NET itself wasn't introduced yet. So we're probably still developing in, for example, Java, C++, or maybe even some people in Visual Basic. Now, it's also the same year that the euro was introduced and we finally got rid of the franc. And it was probably also the same year that Fabiola celebrated our 200th birthday or something, I think. So it was really, really a long time ago. Now, that year wouldn't be important if there were some other things then. Now, one thing that was also happening during the same year was the introduction of something new, a new methodology called extreme programming. And what made extreme programming different was that it, first of all, was a methodology focused at development, and second of all, it really focused on some certain best practices. If you looked at the methodologies that were out there then, for example, Scrum, Agile development, and so on, they were mostly focusing on the project management part. Things like, how am I going to manage my scope? How am I going to manage my requirements? How am I going to take into account risk? And so on. But these methodologies never talk about the development itself. So they leave it completely open to the developer how he's going to do certain practices. And then we see extreme programming. Extreme programming takes a completely different approach. Instead of focusing on the project management part, it really focuses on the development part itself. So how does it do that? It introduces certain best practices. If you look at development today, we have a certain set of best practices. And what does extreme programming do? It takes those best practices, but it applies them to the extreme. To give you one example, what most developers do is we do code reviews. And sooner or later, we ask someone else, okay, can you take a look at my code? And you sit together and you discuss this code. Now, what extreme programming does, it takes the same principle, code reviews, but it applies it to the extreme, by, in this case, introducing pair programming, where someone is constantly sitting next to you and looking at each and every line of code you are writing. So, in extreme programming, you'll see that it combines not only this practice, but also a lot of other practices, and it all takes them to the extreme. And extreme programming was introduced by a guy called Ken Beck. And he was working at a big company, a manufacturer company, and he had to build a project that had failed 3 or 4 times before. And he said, okay, I'm going to redo this again, but this time I'm going to do it differently. And the end result of this doing differently was what we now call extreme programming. And one of the things that Ken Beck said was, if a little testing can eliminate a few flaws, then certainly a lot of testing will eliminate a lot more flaws. So what he's saying here, you take a good practice, testing, and you apply it to the extreme by testing everything. Now, realize this well. I'm talking about the year 1999, so more than 10 years ago. So the thing I'm telling you today, so I'm talking about a technology, a methodology that's over more than 10 years old. And we all know in software development, That's an eternity. So why am I talking about this 10-year-old methodology? And even more important, why are you actually here listening to me talking about this 10-year-old methodology? Now, I thought about it a long time. And I came up with one very big reason. It's actually because we suck. No, we suck completely. We just suck in writing tests. Now, how does this come? Now, for one of those strange reasons, we can write the most fantastic code, the most complex programs. When it comes to testing, we fail completely. So I cannot understand why. So I start to look around, and actually found a lot of different reasons. First reason I heard a lot was people say to me, okay, I'm a programmer, I'm not a tester. Why should I start doing my tests myself? If there's someone out there, we can do it better. Maybe later on I even have to start to write my own documentation or doing my design. If I have an architect, why should I do that? Now, of course, this more sounds like an excuse than like a real good reason. But okay, we can live with it. But this is not the problem I want to talk about today. The second reason I hear a lot is, okay, this is trivial. I've done it 1,000 times before. Why should I write a test for it? I know how it works. And of course, 2 or 4 months later, when the brakes no longer work at Toyota and the cars start crashing, we are in trouble. So we see testing keeps important. But it's still not the reason I want to talk about today. Another reason I hear a lot is, this project is really short in time, so I cannot introduce testing right now, but maybe in the end of the project, if some time is still left, I will then start doing some tests. And of course, we all know that we most certainly will be late, so we can't do any testing. The project will be delivered. It contains thousands and thousands of bugs, so it takes another 6 or 7 months to get everything finally good up and running. So I'm thinking just maybe if we just introduced some testing at the beginning, maybe it will also take some extra time, but not as much as the time we need it now. But who knows? That's still not the reason I want to talk about today. The reason I want to talk today is this one. Developer comes to me and he says to me, okay, I want to do this kind of testing. I'm really interested in it, but my code is just too hard to test. Aha. And that's really the thing I want to focus on right now. One of the big problems I see in software development is that a developer writes some code, another developer writes another component, and sooner or later all these components have to start working together. And we start gluing everything together to make it all up and running. And the only thing we can say that it works, but nothing more. And if we later on have to change that code, we don't like to do it, actually. We are afraid that we're going to break something. I think we all know that we have written that kind of programs before. I certainly know certain places in my code where I say, if I have to change this code, I'm in big trouble. So how can we solve this? Maybe by introducing some testing. Now, here kicks our wise man in. And the wise man says to us, first of all, extraordinary products are just side effects of good habits. What I mean by that is that you don't have to focus on writing good applications yourself. Just by applying certain principles, like for example, you saw in extreme programming, what are all the best practices, just by applying some of these principles, the end result will almost automatically be good code, just by applying some basic skills. So, what's my goal for this presentation? My goal for today is nothing more than help you write testable code. So how can I learn to do that? I'm going to learn to do that by using and introducing a new technology, a new methodology called test-driven development. Now, before we can start going into that, we need to know some basic skills. Some basic skills around unit testing. So first, have a look what a unit test actually is. Now, if you look at all the testing out there, we see a lot of kind of testing. We see functionality testing, we see acceptance testing, We see regression testing, we see load testing, we see black box testing, white box testing, integration testing, functional testing, system testing, sanity testing, performance testing, and so on. Did I miss one? No, I missed no one. So we have a lot of kind of testing out there. So very important to know is that unit testing is just one very specific kind of testing. One of the reasons why I see developers struggle with all this testing is because what they're actually doing is not unit testing, but some other kind of testing. And it's very important to realize that if you're applying testing, that you know in which context you're testing. If you're doing unit tests, you do it in another way than if you're doing integration tests or performance tests. So unit testing is just one very specific kind of testing. Certainly not a lot of other things. How we can best describe a unit test? Unit test is testing really the smallest part of code you can. Well, the granularity depends. It can be one method. It can be a few methods. It can be one class. It can be multiple classes. But most of the time, nothing more than that. We'll certainly not be testing external dependencies. We'll not be testing your database. We'll not be testing your file system, and so on. Now, if you look at the Bible of all knowledge, Wikipedia, they say about unit testing, it's a method of testing the correctness of a particular module of source code. Now, I think this definition is a little bit too wide to really focus on what the unit testing actually is. For me, unit testing is everything focused on one small little part of your system. The small part is very important. So, okay, we know what a unit test is, just testing one very specific functionality, one very specific part of our code. Now let's move on. Why should I unit test? If you start thinking, why on earth should I start doing this? I can tell you a lot of reasons, but I don't want to keep you here until 9 o'clock, so I just picked out the most important one. It's because unit testing will make your life easier. It may make your life easier in certain ways. It makes my life easier to find bugs in your applications. It makes it easier to maintain your application. It will make it easier to understand your application. And of course, it will also make it very easy to develop new functionality. And I think we all agree that making your life easier as a developer is certainly a good thing. Now, also important to realize is that you probably already have done unit testing before. Certainly, if you've written some code, you probably also have written some very small applications, maybe a console application or a small WinForms application, just to test one specific block of your code. This was already a unit test. But it was not meant to be executed many times. It was not meant to be run on all your code. It was not done in a very structured way. And it was certainly not so easy as it should be. But you certainly did it. So let's move to the next part. We know what a unit test is, just testing a small part of our code. We know why we should unit test, because it makes our lives easier. Now, how are we going to write a unit test? Most of the time, if you're going to write unit tests, you start introducing a unit testing framework. Well, the two most known frameworks out there are NUnit and MSTest. NUnit is specifically written to do unit testing. It's a very rich, very fast, and very flexible framework that allows you to write and run your unit tests. On the other hand, you have the MSTest framework. The MSTest framework is much more than a unit testing framework. It also supports integration testing, performance testing, stress testing, and so on. But you can also do unit testing with it. Now, most of the time, if you're going to write the unit tests, it's nothing more, nothing less than just writing a simple class and adding some attributes. So I'm just going to show you in a little demo. So I'm going to open up my Visual Studio. I'm going to do all the demos in MSTest. One of the important benefits of MSTest is that it's certainly very nice integrated into the Visual Studio environment itself. You can also nicely couple it to your build environment and so on. Now, there are some attributes you need to know. So I've just written a small test class. And to say that this is a test class, you have to add an attribute called test class. In this test class, we can add some tests. I'm going to say that this is a unit test. Oh, okay, I just have to add the test method attribute to my method. Now, I also have some other attributes. What I also can do, I can run certain code before my test class is executed, and I can specify using the class initialize method, and also after all my tests in my class are executed through the class cleanup method. I can do the same thing before each test is run using the test initialize, and after each test is run using test cleanup. I think this is nothing new here. I'm just going to run my tests. And very important to know is that in your test class, it will certainly make sure that the class initialize will be run first, so all the setup and all the correct configuration can be done. Then all the tests will be run, and each and every test will be run on a separate thread. It's very important to keep in mind, because sometimes you can get strange side effects if you don't take this into account. So, and all the tests are successful. So in my class initialize, I've written out a certain text. You see, in the debug trace window, I can see this here. So this is called before any test is executed, and this is called after all tests are executed. And if you look at the test methods themselves, we see the same results. This time, we have one line that's called before each test. Then the test itself is called. It's also saying I'm running on one specific thread. And of course, we also had a cleanup after each and every test. And we'll see, if you look at the other tests, they are running on different threads. This one on thread 19, this one on thread 21. Nothing new there. But I just want to show this because it's important to keep in mind what we're actually doing here. Let's get back to the slides. Now, I just showed you how to write a unit test. So probably, most of you already have written this kind of code before. Now we come to the important part. How are we going to write good unit tests? That's a little bit more difficult. First thing the wise man says to us is, test code is just code. Aha. This tells us actually a lot. This means that all the conventions, all the principles of good programming you're applying in your normal code, you're also going to have to apply in your testing code. What I see a lot is that developers were really focusing on removing all the copy-paste code in a normal code. Once they go to the test, they just start copy-pasting everything together. No, we cannot do that. If we're going to apply unit testing, we're going to have to apply the same principles we are just applying on our normal code. Principles like, for example, naming conventions. If you got a good naming conventions for your normal methods, just apply the same principle for your testing methods. Also things like refactoring. If you're going to refactor your normal code, just also refactor your testing code. We're going to see this later on, but this is important. Now let's go through some of the typical test code anti-patterns and how we're going to solve them. First anti-pattern I want to show you is the typical cut and paste problem. We have some configuration that we have to run for each and every test. And most of the time, developers just click it, cut, and paste it in another test, and run it again. Now, how are we going to solve this? We're going to solve it like we do in all normal code, just by introducing some refactoring. We can do just an extract method to move this functionality to a separate method. We can maybe move it to a test initialize method, or we can do some other stuff. A lot of opportunities there. Second problem I see a lot is poor encapsulation. This means that our objects are actually leaking functionality through all sites. And it makes them very hard to configure and then place them in a certain state that they become easy to test. Now, how are we going to solve this? We're going to solve this by, for example, introducing a builder pattern that helps us to build up our test class in a certain state. We can also introduce fluent interface patterns that make it more readable to build up this state. Other thing I see a lot is we have got a really bloated setup. So creating our tests and making sure that we have a certain state before we start introducing a real code takes a lot of code. So how can we solve that? We can solve that, for example, by introducing fake objects or isolation frameworks, where you replace the real behavior of your application by fake objects. I'm going to show you a demo of that later on. But also can happen, of course, that it's really just too hard to write a test. Well, then there's only one option you have. You have to start refactoring your code. It doesn't have to be hard, but you have to do it. And of course, sometimes it's just really too hard to really do unit testing. For example, if you have some code that is reading information from the file system or reading information from a database, and replacing it by fake objects is just too hard in a certain scenario, just remember that there's also integration testing. It's perfectly fine that you don't unit test everything. There are some occasions where it's really too hard to do that. So in that case, you can switch to integration testing or maybe another kind of testing. Now, another important pattern that can help you a lot is the 3A pattern. So thanks to the 3A pattern, it helps us to really structure our test code in a very specific way. And we see three important parts. First part is the arrange part, where we actually create a situation and make the system in such a state that we can start with testing. The second part, of course, is the act part. We're actually going to do our test. And the last part is the assert part, where we're going to verificate the results and actually the test has run like we should expect. So let's give you a quick demo. I've got a small calculator class in here. And if you look at the calculator class, it had one method divide in this case, and we're going to just start doing some tests on it. I'm going to make myself difficult. I'm going to create just a very simple test. Divide, okay. And we're going to apply this 3A pattern. So we've got an arrange part, an act part, and of course also an assert part. So in the arrange part, we create all the objects, all the things that are necessary to start running our tests. We move on to the act part, where we're actually going to do our tests. And I can also introduce all my variables. It's always the best practice to also introduce them at the arrange part. So my two values I'm expecting here, I'm going to specify them also here. And if I can calculate well, I'll make this a float, make it a little bit more easy. It's actually the other way around, of course. Now, it's always a good idea to also use the var keyword when you're writing your tests. So if you start later on doing some refactoring, it prevents that you have to rewrite a lot of stuff. And we also set the results. And in the assert part, we're actually going to validate that the results are as expected. In this case, of course, stupid also already set the results. Gonna set it to 0. And expected. And I'm going to validate that actually the thing I expect is the same thing as we got back from the method. So if my math is still good, and I just forgot one thing, adding test method attribute, of course, otherwise it will not find the test. We can just run and validate the result. And we see everything is fine. So this looks like a very simple approach. Just by structuring your test in a certain way, it seems very simple, but if you start doing this, you will see that your test already becomes a lot easier and a lot more structured. And you will also immediately see when you're doing really too much in one test. So for example, if you end up with these parts that are becoming too big, for example, if you're doing multiple things here, then you actually have to split up in multiple tests. If you're doing multiple asserts in one test, you also have to start splitting it up. Because otherwise, for example, if this one fails and at the second assert, you will never know that the second assert probably also failed. That's already a good indication of how hard it is to write a specific test. If you see that these methods became small and remain small, you are good. If they become bigger and bigger, you have to start refactoring. Now let's look at another toy that can help us a lot. Another thing we can do is what we call mocking. And when you do with mocking, we're going to replace real objects by fake objects. For example, if you have your file system and you don't want to test exactly against your file system, but you just only want to test one specific part of your code, so you can mock all the rest, all the other things around it. So if you look at the viral file knowledge again, what Wikipedia says to us, mock objects are simulated objects that mimic the behavior of real objects in controlled ways. So they are actually fake objects, but we can make sure that they always return the same result. So instead of calling into a database and asking for a list of products, we're calling into a fake object that will always return us the same results, the same data, the same list of products. So it also makes testing a lot easier. So let's give you a demo. Most of the time, you can introduce mocking in two ways. You can do it manually, by just writing a mock object yourself. Or what you also can do, you can use mocking frameworks. I'm going to give you a sample of both. Let's look at the thing I want to test. I just created a very small countdown application. At the end of the countdown, this application, what it will do, it will launch me an object. For example, a rocket. So imagine if I couldn't replace this rocket by a fake object, by a mock object. In that case, I had to launch really a rocket each time and every time I run this test. That's kind of stupid. We don't want to do that. So what I did instead, I put my rocket behind an interface, an iLaunchable interface. And it's one method called launch. So what we want to test now is actually that at the end of the countdown, that our countdown really called the launch method on my unlaunchable object. So I'm going to delete this one and just create it again. So I already arranged it a little bit. So what do I need? I need a launchable object. We're going to create it. And I can already start using some new functionality in Visual Studio 2010, like for example, generate class. And you can even generate it in different places. But in this case, of course, our mock object belongs into our test project, so I can just create it here. Okay, we got our mocket rocket. Sounds nice. And our mocket rocket will implement this iLaunchable interface. So how gonna assert this that it actually is called? Just by introducing one extra property. And I set this to true once the launch method is called. So what is wrong? Of course, have to be a bool. Voila. So that's the only thing I need to do. Most of the time, if you look at creating fake objects, if you look at creating mock objects, it's most of the time most easy to do it yourself. I only go into mocking frameworks when it's really needed. Most of the time, it's just a little bit easier if you just create it yourself. Okay, we're gonna go back to our test. We've got a rocket. Gonna initiate our countdown. And it expects that I specify how long the countdown will take, 10 seconds, and we specify our rocket. We're gonna initiate. I'm looking for the right methods. I'm just gonna take a look. Ah, start method, how can I forget? Call the start, and after the countdown is completed, we expect that our launch on the Mocket rocket is called. We're gonna verify it. Okay, let's run it. And this works. Okay, let's now replace this manual mock by a mocking framework. In this case, I'm gonna use RhinoMox. And what I have to do there, I have to say to RhinoMox, okay, generate me a mock. And it asks me, okay, from which type is this mock? It's of type iLaunchable. And then I have to change my assert. So instead of asking a property I generate myself is called, I just gonna take the mock object, and I can say assert was called, and I have to specify which method on the iLaunchable object is actually called. In this case, of course, it's the launch method. So we see that in this case, using manual mocks or automated mocks will probably be almost take the same amount of time. And it also works. Now, one other thing before we can start talking about test-driven development itself is some other guidelines that help you write good tests. They also were called the first aid for unit tests. First one is the F, fast. This means, not more or less, that just your unit tests have to be running fast. If they take too long to run, you get into trouble. And sooner or later, you will say, okay, I'm gonna stop running this test. It just takes too long. So make sure that each and every unit test just take a few milliseconds, if possible. Less is even better. Second thing, make sure that the unit tests are running isolated. This means that, first of all, your unit tests can run in any order, and they're completely separated from each other. So you don't end up in trouble if test A starts first and then test B is executed, while you are actually expecting that it will be run the other way around. So each and every test needs to be run completely in isolation. Third one, the tests have to be repeatable. If I run this test right now, and I run it 2 seconds later, 2 minutes later, 2 months later, it still have to work. So if you start depending on external things like databases or even simpler things like daytime.now, you really take this into account that you end up in trouble because you're depending on external file system, external things. So make sure that you can run your test over and over again. Another important thing, of course, is that tests are self-validating. It wouldn't be a good idea if you have more than 1,000 unit tests and if you start checking them all manually, okay, if this test succeeded, it actually means that something is written to the file system, so I'm gonna open up my file system, look at a certain location, if a file is written there, okay, if this file is actually written there, the test has succeeded. You don't wanna do that. And last very important one, of course, the tests that always have to be created in a timely fashion. So I'm not talking about fast running tests, I'm talking about the time you need to create a unit test. If it takes more time to write your unit tests than your real code, then you're probably doing something wrong. Maybe you have to refactor your code. Maybe you're trying to test too much. maybe you're actually writing an integration test, not a unit test. So if it takes just too long, start thinking. You're probably doing something wrong. So this is it for the unit testing part. So with this, with all the basics knowledge, to start introducing test-driven development. So first of all, what is test-driven development? Now the biggest problem with test-driven development is actually its name. Because the first thing you hear in it is this word test. Where actually, test-driven development is not about testing. It's more focused on design and development. It's a methodology, a way of working that helps you design and develop your code. And how are you going to do that? You're going to do that by testing first. So it's a big difference. The goal is not writing an enormous list of unit tests. No, the goal is writing and creating a good design. So developing your application in a certain way that becomes maintainable, extensible, and so on. And one way how you're going to get there is just by applying test-driven development. Now, very important if you start applying TDD is that you try to produce the simplest thing that work. And also very important, this doesn't mean the dumbest thing that work. So I'm going to give you an example later on of that, of how applying the dumbest thing can get you into trouble. So what this makes possible that your design will evolve and continue and grow and grow and grow through your unit tests. So very important, you start from the requirements. And based on the requirements, and not the requirements you are expecting in 10 years, no, the requirements you're having today, and based on these requirements, you start writing simple solutions. Also important, just write enough code to satisfy this one simple requirement, nothing else. So most of you, if you've already heard about test-driven development, you see the same thing coming over and over again. One important side note, by applying this test-driven development approach, you end up with code that's really satisfying your requirements. Nothing more, but also nothing less. If you start applying TDD, you probably already heard of this typical approach, the red-green refactor. The first step is always making your test fail. Now, in most examples you see out there, they just don't have written any implementation. Of course, this test will fail. But also, that's not the reason why you have to make sure your test fails. The reason why you start doing this is because you have to assure that you don't end up with a false positive. This means if you just run your test right now without really implementing this requirement, we cannot end up in a situation where our test already succeeds, because probably then we are maybe testing the wrong thing or we're doing something else wrong, but we're certainly not doing the right thing. Therefore, it's important that our test always starts with failing. Then, of course, we start implementing it. And we keep in mind, try to do the simplest thing as possible. Of course, the simple thing is most of the time not the best thing, because we probably forget some other things that we have taken into account. So after this step, we also start introducing some refactoring. And we try the software we have written as simple as possible, and now we make it better, make it more reusable, more maintainable, more extensible, and so on. So typically, the TDD cycle looks like this. We start with a specific requirement. And based on this requirement, we're going to write a simple test. We run this test, and as we don't have written any implementation yet, or we don't have added some extra functionality, we expect that the test will fail. Then we write the code, of course, to make it all running. We run a test again, and now we expect it succeeds. And then we take a second look at our code. And we say, okay, we have written this, it works, how can we make it better? So we start introducing some refactoring. And after doing this refactoring, we expect that of course our tests are still succeeding. So we run our tests again, and we hopefully end up with still running application and running tests. And we do this over and over again for each and every requirement. So very important to realize is that, in fact, writing a unit test is just a nice side effect. The most important part is the design aspect. They're ending up with a really nice design and a certain approach that helps us to create and maintain our applications in a certain way. So why is this important? First of all, it gives us a big confidence boost. So if you've written an application and you have a code coverage of 70-80%, you have more than 1,000 unit tests, and you come home and you look at the test results and all tests are succeeding, you feel good. And you're also not afraid to start changing your existing code, because you are sure that once I change something, that the unit test will indicate me what's wrong. Also important, of course, is that by doing TDD, you cannot end up with untestable code. Because to start with test first, you cannot do anything else than just ending up with testable code. So now, how are we going to apply this TDD approach? Imagine we have a component A, and this component A is dependent on component B, and component A is also dependent on component C, and so on. We're going to start unit testing that. Now, if you start asking yourself this kind of questions, you are actually not doing TDD. You're probably doing normal unit testing, wirebox unit testing, or maybe something like integration testing. If you start applying TDD, you have another kind of work, another way of working. One very, very important, and what I think is the most hardest part to do, is when you start applying TDD, that you cannot write your code in your head before you write a test. So most of the time we're already thinking, we've read a requirement and we start thinking about it and we start thinking about all the other stuff that's maybe needed. So we start adding already a lot of extra stuff. Well, we can't do that in the TDD approach. It's really focusing, first of all, on the simple solution that works. And later on, once you've written it, you have a real better insight of what's really needed, and then you can start refactoring it. So try to prevent this. Really focus on writing the simplest thing. Also very important is that by applying TDD, you will be the first user of application. And the end user will only be the second user. So if you have written something wrong, and if your API is hard to use, it's you who are feeling the pain. You have to suffer all the things you have done wrongly when designing this small component. So, by applying TDD, we end up with good design. There are some very important design principles when creating applications, and normally we have to start thinking about them ourselves. You have to make sure that you apply all these principles to end up with a good and maintainable application. Now, by applying TDD, this comes for free. First one you get is a typical Yagni problem. You ain't gonna need it. So most developers, if they start writing applications, they of course add the necessary stuff, but they also add some new shiny toys that they think they are very useful and very fun to write, so just don't want to add it. But maybe it's not even needed, or they're just thinking in the wrong direction. So by doing the simplest thing that works, we prevent that you're going to end up in a situation where you're applying Yagni. You ain't going to need it. A second thing that comes for free when applying TDD is dry. Don't repeat yourself. So what I'm talking about here is a typical copy-paste code we see everywhere. So by applying TDD, you first write the simplest thing as possible. And in that case, it can be that you're writing the same code as you've written somewhere else. But don't forget the third step in TDD, the refactoring step. In that case, after writing the simple solution that works, and maybe that was just by copy-pasting some code, you're going to refactor it to make reuse of their existing code. So in this case, you end up having a simple and dry application. Another thing you get for free is that you can start applying the law of Demeter. Now, the law of Demeter actually says that you can't talk to strangers. What do I mean by that? This means once you have a class, and this class has dependencies on other classes, for example, our class A has dependency on class B, and class B itself is talking to a class C, but the law of Demeter says to us that we can only call class C through a method on class B. We cannot call through pointing out class A dot class B dot class C dot a certain method. We cannot do that. We really have to go through a method on our direct friends. So by doing this, our lives already becomes a lot easier. Because otherwise, imagine if we're talking to class C directly through class B. If you start introducing some mocking and fake objects, we had to mock and class B and class C. So by applying this law of Demeter, our mocking already becomes a lot easier, because we only have the thing we need to mock are our direct friends, our direct dependencies, nothing more. Another thing we get for free is we're going to start applying the single responsibility principle. And what the single responsibility principle means is that each and every class and each and every method has one very specific responsibility. And of course, this also means it ends up with having one simple reason to change. If you have to open up a method for two different reasons to start applying some changes, then you're not applying the single responsibility principle. So by applying TDD, you're writing very simple classes, very simple methods to apply one very specific requirement, you get it for free. Another one you get for free is the interface segregation principle. And what this means in this case, it means if you start programming, it will start programming against an abstraction and not to a very concrete implementation. You can just easily translate it as just talk to an interface, not an implementation. And the last one you get for free is the inversion of control principle. The inversion of control principle is also known as the Hollywood principle. And it actually is saying, if you have an object who has a dependency on other objects, don't let your object create and call this object directly. No, instead, let these dependencies be injected through your constructor or through specific properties. In this way, they become easy to replace, easy to mock, and easy to change. So let's give you a quick demo. I defined some very specific requirements about creating a stack, something that we all can understand and very easy to create. I've just written some requirements. Okay, first thing I say, when I create a stack, I must make sure that the stack is empty. Then I'm going to try to put a single object on the stack, and of course, we then expect that it's empty is false. If you put an item on the stack, we remove it again, is empty must be true again. So these are all the requirements I can think of right now. So maybe later on, if you start implementing it, some new requirements will kick in. But I don't will take a look too far ahead in the future. No, we are focusing on the requirements today and writing the simplest thing that can work right now. So I'm going to create a test class. I'm going to call it unbounded going to apply necessary attributes. This is the first one. And when you start applying TDD, we most of the time start focusing on the simplest test first. So I think this first one, creating a stack and verifying that it's empty is true, is a good one to start doing it. So I'm also going to apply the arrange act and assert, of course. Now, what's also important, I'm using a new feature in Visual Studio 2010 called the suggestion mode. So normally, when you're typing, the IntelliSense will try to complete the clauses and the variables you're typing. But of course, if I end up creating tests first and later on the implementation, then the IntelliSense will only annoy me and always do the wrong suggestions. So by changing the IntelliSense mode from completion mode to suggestion mode, this goes away. And the first thing I can think of, I need, of course, a stack. And we're going to call it unbounded stack. We're going to generate a class. And this stack must have is empty will be false. That's what we expect. So I'm going to verify that when we call the stack, this is effectively true. So in this case, I don't know why it's complaining. Of course, I see. Indeed, I forgot to create a method first. We're going to name it create stack. This is our first test. Voila, that's already a little bit better. And we're going to ask it to create a property for that. And we're going to validate the result. Just apply the test method attributes, and we are good to go. Let's run this test. So this one succeeds. And this is what they expected. So in this case, we already have a false positive without really thinking about the implementation. So how does this come? This comes by default, a Boolean value is always false. So we're going to change it to make sure that it's really the behavior as we expected. So once we created our unbounded stack, we expect that isEmpty is false. Run it again, and of course, still have to succeed. Voila. We satisfy our first requirement. Do we need to write more tests for this? Well, probably I think not. Let's move to the second one. Second requirement is we push an item on the stack, and isEmpty must be false. Now, okay. I'm just going to create a second test. Copy-paste some stuff to make my life easier. We're going to push an item on the stack. And in this case, we expect this is empty. I'm doing something wrong here. See it if I look at the results. Assert must be is true. And why does it fail? Let's have a look. I'm going to see why does it fail. Because, of course, once I created a stack, this empty must be true. Kind of stupid mistake of me. Okay, let's rerun this again. We're good to go. Second case. Now we're going to do, we're going to push an item on the stack. Just create a simple string, and we're going to push it on the stack. We're going to let him generate implementation. Let's jump to it. It tells me immediately a result. I don't like that. I'm going to change it to void. going to allow it to specify anything I want. And in this case, I can still do the simplest thing that works, just by saying once the push is called, I can say this dot is empty equals false, of course. I'm getting confused. Let's get back at our code. In this case, I will just call this. And in the second line, I will set the result is empty. You check again if the stack is actually in this case, it must be false. So we're going to see if this works. Maybe I did something wrong. It seems to work. Now, if you look at the implementation, it's kind of stupid. Did I satisfy the requirement right now? We could say, if you only read the specific thing that's saying here, you can say yes. But then we start looking at the thing I said before. You don't only have to implement the simplest thing that works, but it can be the dumbest thing. In this case, I just did the dumbest thing. It works, but of course, it's not anything useful. I'm going to change it a little bit. I'm going to create or maybe a list of objects. It doesn't matter that much. So I'm also applying the third step, the refactoring step. So I'm making sure that what I'm doing here, first of all, works, but it's also a good design. Not only the dumbest thing that can actually work. If you see a lot of examples about test-driven development out there, you see it always start with a very stupid implementation. If you do it like that, of course, you end up spending a lot of time creating all kinds of functionality. You don't want to do that. So let's make our isEmpty a little bit smarter. Maybe a good effecting is also remove the setter and make sure that in this case the isEmpty will check if the list of objects dot count equals zero. And if that is true, we can certainly say that our stack is empty. So remove this line. And change this code, so really add our item to the stack. And let's run our test again. Okay, and this succeeds. So what I did right now is not only applying some certain basic skills that help us to write very simple implementations, but we also make sure that we're not writing the dumbest thing. It's a real balance about at which moment do I have to start thinking further? Do I have to take some things into account right now? Or should I better first start really writing the simplest thing and then moving on in the refactoring step? So most of the time I do it like that. So I start with really the simplest thing and then after that, if it works, if you have a succeeding test, you move on. And you start doing refactoring. Because in this way, you have a big safety net. If you start changing stuff, you are sure that what you are doing will not break your existing requirements. Now, what I can do, I can also start adding some extra tests, but I'm going to keep it like this. And I'm just going to move on to the next part. So one important question remains, when should I apply TDD? And the wise man kicks in again and he says to us, if it's worth building, then I think it's worth testing. And if it's not worth testing, then why are you building anyway? But I'm trying to say here that doing TDD can be done on any kind of project. Either it's a big project, a small project, a complex project, it doesn't matter. We always take benefit from it. And we see also in the end up, it will take less and less time. In first, of course, we'll have some extra time to start writing also tests. But of course, it gives you the freedom to start refactoring and make your code better. And you end up with having less bugs and better code. So we always win. Now, is this TDD then actually the solution to all those problems? TDD actually leaves some other questions open. Questions like, where do I start? Questions like, what should I test and what should I not test? How much do I test? When do I know that I actually have tested enough? I don't know. TDD doesn't tell me anything about it. Another important issue is, how do I name my test? You see, when you start writing tests, sooner or later you start to struggle. And you come into a situation where it's hard to find a very good and descriptive way to say, okay, this is actually what I'm testing right now. And also important one is, how do I know why my test failed? You see that your test failed, and look at the test name, but it tells you actually nothing. You don't have any clue why this is actually happening. So let's look at the last part. Let's look at behavior-driven development and how BDD can solve and help you answer some of these questions. Well, first of all, BDD was introduced by a guy called Dan Nord. And it's very important to know that if you start applying BDD, behavior-driven development, you're first of all applying the same skills that you've already learned and applying TDD. So all the same things and all the same benefits, testable code, good design, and so on, you already get it for free. Now, where is it different? What I find peculiar is that, in fact, most developers don't have any problem writing thousand lines of code. You give them an application, they start reading through it, and they're really enjoying it, reading through all this code. But if you give them the same amount of lines, but in documentation, they're not very happy, they don't like it. So on one kind, developers don't like to read documentation, but on the other side, they don't have any problem with looking through the code. So what BDD is going to do, it will make sure that our code actually becomes a documentation. So, if you look at BDD, it's focusing on the requirements of our application. In contrast to TDD, where TDD starts from the requirement, where the things we are implementing and writing are focusing on the APIs and the solution, how we're going to change this requirement to the real implementation. So TDD is actually focusing on the technical APIs we are creating to make everything work. BDD is different. BDD is really, really focusing on the requirements themselves. And most of the time, if you get requirements, you get them in a certain way. You get them in the form of, for example, user stories. And user story is written using, most of the time, a certain syntax, for example, this one. As a, for example, administrator, I want to log in using this page so that I can manage the users in the application. That's a simple user story. And this user story will be verified using some acceptance criteria. And also acceptance criteria can be written using a certain syntax. Given certain conditions, given that the administrator isn't logged in yet, and the application is available, when he clicked on the login button, then his username and password must be sent to the application, and so on. So we really define some very specific steps, some very specific actions that help us to verify that our requirements are actually implemented well. So if you take this concept and apply it to the BDD, you will see there that these acceptance criteria, so these different steps you've defined and say, okay, once these different steps, these different acceptance criteria are met, then our requirement is fulfilled. And you will see when you're applying BDD that you will change and take those acceptance criteria and apply them using your tests. So in the end, what this makes possible, if an end user or business person starts looking at all your tests, Then I see things that he knows. He sees requirements and sees acceptance criteria. So he can make sure for himself that things you are doing are really verifying the right stuff. Now, there are some frameworks that can help you to do that, but in essence, it's nothing more than just applying some simple naming patterns when creating tests. So let's give you a quick sample. I've got a small BDD demo here. And first of all, I applied the TDD approach, where I just set some simple method names that are really focusing on the API itself and not on the requirements behind it. Now, if you take the same concept and apply it to BDD, then you're going to reuse, for example, your namespace to specify the given, this is the context of the application. You reuse your class name to specify some conditions, and you reuse your method names to specify the results you expect. And if you run this test, you end up, if I add some extra columns, and start structuring it in a different way, come on, can't I do it in one run? So if I then start looking at the list of all my tests and all the tests that have been run, I end up seeing things like given I have no stack, and when creating a new stack, then the stack should be empty. So it's really an exercise of finding the right naming conventions to translate your acceptance criteria into good tests. And by doing this, you end up with having tests that are perfectly readable by your business people. So, the only thing left is some takeaways. First of all, just remember that test-driven development isn't something new. It's already been out there for several years. You certainly will find a lot of books, a lot of people who already tried to apply it, so you can learn a lot from them. So don't think you are alone when you start doing it. Second of all, TDD, test-driven development, is not focusing on testing itself. It's actually focusing on design. And of course, you end up writing testable code. That's just merely a side effect. In essence, TDD, you have to see it as an exercise that helps you to apply all the principles I've laid out, try, Yagni, and so on, and you get them for free. And the last thing to remember is BDD, behavior-driven development, is nothing more than an evolution out of TDD. So you apply the same principles, the same concepts, but do it in a certain way, it also become readable and understandable by business people. So define your test cases, your test scenarios in such a way that the business people understand what you're actually trying to achieve. Instead of when applying TDD, where you're more focusing on technical APIs to get the requirements written down. So with this, I conclude my presentation. Are there any questions? I still have 5 minutes left. I know it's late, so probably you all want to go home. No questions? Don't see any hands. There's many lights. I see one hand. Yes?
I'm just wondering, in all the demos and videos and whatnot that you see about TDD and DDD, the real examples that you see are always pretty simple, isolated cases like a stack or a tuple. Do you have any comments on how to apply those principles in kind of business scenarios?
Okay, so the question is, Most demos we see out there are actually very simple demos, how we can start applied in real applications. Now, it all comes to object-oriented programming. And one of the things that's very important in object-oriented programming is just creating the simple solutions, simple objects, and simple structures that make everything work. Now, of course, in most samples you see out there, we have to create and run a test in a very specific condition to make it all understandable for everyone. But it's easily applicable on any kind of project. There are no specific cases where I can say, in this case, I cannot apply TDD. Because in essence, it's focusing on writing applications in an object-oriented way. And this can be done anywhere. Some other questions? Okay. Then I want to thank you all for listening, and I wish you all a safe trip home. Thank you.